What we're talking about here is avoidance because of anxiety. We're talking about a very specific kind of anxiety, and this is very important. Social anxiety, as differentiated between generalized anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorder, panic attack, we're talking about anxiety here, the basis of which is fear of rejection, fear of failure. It is performance anxiety. Like it or not, life is not fair. It's not. We live in a very competitive society. It's very fast-paced. It's very technological. If you do not know how to compete, if you do not know how to be productive, you will not make it, or you will make it in limited fashion. When you tack on the added issues of learning disabilities, selective mutism, developmental disabilities, it's more of an uphill struggle. But I can assure you that anxiety is the major component that has to be dealt with. It is your basic instinct as a parent to nurture your child. Nurturing, this is where we get a little confused, because nurturing is misdefined. All too often it means, I will take care of my child, I will rescue the child, I will make sure he or she does not experience pain. The more you are doing that, not that you're not wrong, you don't want your child to experience pain, of course, but the more that you do that, the more you are enabling the addiction to avoidance. How will the child learn? How do we deal with anxiety? This is what we do. There are different levels. And often I'm asked, what kind of therapy do you do? My answer is, I do whatever works therapy. I mean that. I'm certainly not Freudian. I am eclectic. When I started my practice, I started with biofeedback and psychotherapy. Anybody know what biofeedback is? Sophisticated equipment that helps people understand what goes on in the body, so we have the mind-body connection, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes. But and there's a philosophy there of behavioral medicine where you're teaching a patient to heal themselves. But what do you do when the patient doesn't want to be healed? What do you do when they're resistant? Well, you better have an answer or you're not going to be productive. In terms of anxiety, on a behavioral level, what we're doing is we're helping the person get out of their comfort zone to face the fear. The right way to do that is with support and insight. I am very often asked the question, how do you get a person who is not motivated to be motivated? Well, there is an answer. What we have here is a dependence syndrome. Dependency, remember? We talked about it at the beginning. Avoidance, dependency. So we take a look at the dependency, and we teach the parents or those dependent upon to modify, to make changes in the environment on which the person is dependent so that we get that person's attention. We manipulate back in a constructive way so that the person doesn't take things for granted. If the person is, I mean, I have a lot of people who come to me who are very high functioning, who have a lot of motivation, who are not that resistant, and it really becomes easy. But I am used to dealing with very, very resistant people. I'll give you an example. I have one person, for example, I do a certain amount of telephone therapy. I can only do this with people who are high-functioning and motivated. And the only reason I do it is because there are no programs around the country. This woman calls me up. She's from Boca Raton. And her words to me were, Jonathan, she was an ovarian cancer survivor. And she said, Jonathan, I'd rather be back in chemotherapy than speak in front of a group of 30 people. She's 80% better via phone therapy. That's because she's motivated. How long does therapy take, someone asks. Well, how fast do you learn is my answer. Okay? How fast do you learn? How motivated are you? Okay, behaviorally, we help the person get out of their comfort zone with support and insight. There is deeper work that has to be done. And the deeper work involves working with the emotional conflict, the specific emotions of fear of rejection, fear of losing, fear of not winning, embarrassment, humiliation, shame. This can be very deep. And I know a lot of you are thinking, how can my child ever talk about this stuff? You know, well, it's on a relative basis. Then the other thing that we have to look for is how much autonomic hypersensitivity exists, meaning how reactive is the person's physiology? Because this can happen. This is a fact of life. And when this happens, the most common example of this is when people have panic attacks. And a panic attack can be very debilitating, and it comes in different degrees. A panic attack, for the most part, is an exaggerated emotional reaction. What is happening is that the body somatizes the emotions. A primary emotion which is being repressed is anger and frustration. Anger is a real key here. If a person does not have a friend, is not making it in life, is not having happiness or success, I guarantee you there's some anger. So we are trying to get to the underlying emotions. And number three, if there is this autonomic hypersensitivity, we try to deal with it. And there are different levels. Number one, we try to do a little biofeedback, mind-body relaxation. Number two, we do natural pharmacology, you know, St. John's wort, kava kava, inositol. These are all different things. It's very complex. Sometimes it's harder than giving the right medication. And number three, medication sometimes is needed. Our philosophy is that it is better to do it in a natural way. Most of the people that we work with, we try to do it without medication. But sometimes, you know, when there is a severe depression, when there are substantial issues of obsessiveness or obsessive compulsivity, you've got to be open-minded to medication. When they had that Dateline show about elective mutism, MSNBC called me the next day to do a rebuttal, but I couldn't do it because I was busy with patients. But I heard the guy responding, some doctor who absolutely did not know anything that he was talking about with elective mutism, because what he said was, I've never seen a child who doesn't grow out of this. Well, I can tell you, I've seen people who have not grown out of elective mutism. And if you don't get this particular thing at an early age, it will be very debilitating. But he did say one important thing. It was a very important phrase. He said, you might not want to give medication to children because you are, quote, bathing the brain in chemicals, which is true. But when you saw that show, and 6 months after the child took Prozac, it did look like a miracle. This is why you have to be objective. You know, there's a big, what are the side effects of medication? That's an important issue. What are the side effects of not having a social life? Being depressed, having debilitating self-esteem. This is why you have to look at the whole picture. Any questions about anxiety? Don't be anxious. Very good question. How do you get a person out of a comfort zone? First, you try reason. I always believe on starting with a positive psychology. You try reason. When reason breaks down, you have two choices. You either accept the person's behavior and attitude, or you learn to integrate a modified approach of tough love, which I will talk about in a moment, which is empowering the person out of the comfort zone, and it does necessitate positive stress. Positive stress. Can anybody give me a
Johnson,
one?
Johnson, how about taking out of the comfort zone altogether? It's not comfortable no more. It's not more comfortable, that's all. I'm not doing your homework no more. I'm not calling your friend no more. It's not comfortable no more. Well, he must react to something that is not comfortable. If you're doing everything for me, I don't want to do it. Why would I do it? I mean, if my wife cooks all the time, I don't cook. She doesn't cook. I have to do something about it. Well, first of all, you have to teach them that there are much more possibilities than their comfortable zone. There are many, many other areas. First, let's learn about it. Because when they are stuck with their comfortable zone, and we as the parents always there for them, we don't know that they're stuck. We're stuck, however, too. They feel comfortable about it. Let's change something about us. You know, I go home sometime at 10 o'clock at night, and my family sits upstairs there watching TV, and I'll say, hi guys, I'm here, and say, all right. So I got fed up because I feel like they need to know that I am there, and they maybe should say something. So I came one day and didn't say anything. And after 10 minutes, somebody said, is that his home? Thank God, they think of me. So I just changed a little bit, just a little bit, change. So comfortable zone is not necessarily comfortable, or if it's comfortable, make it uncomfortable.
With support and with insight. Yes?
I've worked with retarded adults for a number of years. And one of the things that I saw was if I took them out of their comfort zone, they just stopped functioning altogether. Now, I understand part of it was because they were levels of retardation. And the ones that I had was moderate. They were about between 70 and 79 in the IQ scale, you know, that we had to go by. But the point I'm making is that I have seen it even with myself. Take me out of my comfort zone and I just stop functioning.
Everybody has a different chemistry. Everybody has a different ego strength. What one person can handle, the next person cannot. That's why I don't want you leaving here and throwing your kids out of the house. You know, There is a methodology to this, and the methodology is based on how well you know the person. Before Eliran or my staff or myself are doing the getting out of the comfort zone component, we have a relationship with that person. We know what's going on. So we're giving you a conceptual framework, but there's a lot of individualization that is needed within that context. Anxiety questions? Yeah. Okay, very good. And that's a great example of you do a little role-playing and the person can respond. Sometimes, however, the anxiety can be absolutely paralyzing. I did an intake on parents last week. This is really pathetic, I have to say. They have a 14-year-old, and the 14-year-old is a good, no learning disabilities, good kid, picked on in school. Very poor social life. He'll see somebody, you know, he'll be at the mall shopping with his parents. He'll see one of his peers. He'll look down. He won't. They read my book. At least the mother did. Had a good session. And then at the end, the mother says, I want you to tell me how at the end of every session, my child will walk out feeling okay. Okay, I said I'm not a magician. I'm a good therapist. I am not a magician. Do you get what I'm talking about here? These parents were considering, because this was so overwhelming stress, these parents were considering moving. Can you imagine? Moving because of the stress that this child was under. But what was happening here is here's a wonderful example of how the parents have to manage their own anxiety. They have to get out of their comfort zone before the child can be helped. Once had a person who was school phobic. We do a lot of work with that. And that's a real deadly thing. You know, when a person is has a school phobia, you have a real breakdown in the system. It is the result of a major anxiety disorder. It is the result of profound parental confusion. And this one particular situation, the mother, in my taking the history, had explained she had taken the child to 9 different schools. At what point do you stand and do what's right? That's an open-ended question. I don't have the answer. It's different for everybody. Okay, but there's another example of enabling. Yes?
My question is, if you have a family with a child and you're doing therapy, what kind of involvement or do you do with the school district? If it's a middle school child or high school child, what kind of work do you do with the school so that there's continuity between family and school?
Well, sometimes we do it. Sometimes we don't. I'm going to let Eliran handle that for a moment because she's had a lot of experience.
Well, we have a lot of experience with dealing with schools. A lot of time, or most of the time, it will be, in fact, telephone. We'll call the school psychologist. A lot of time, we'll talk to the school teacher. A lot of time, the school doesn't want us to be involved at all, and we have to respect that. If we won't, the child will suffer, because the child will become kind of an enemy. And a lot of schools will say, please come. Just tell us what to do. I was working with a little child who's 7 years old, doing EEG biofeedback for attention deficit, and that's sitting in front of a computer and moving a fish with her brain waves.
We'll talk about that in a minute. That was a little confusing.
She told the kid that she's moving the fish with her brain wave, and they all said, you are crazy as well as you are not a good student. And the teacher called me to ask what's going on. So I explained to her what's going on. And she said, since you are there, can you help me, please, what to do when I feel that she is not concentrating? Because most of the time I would say to her, please do concentrate. Come on, it's very important. I'm trying to encourage her, but nothing's helping. What shall I do? I said, well, just ask her to move the fish, because that's what she does in my office. And she said, can you just move the fish? And there's some kind of secret between the teacher and the student, and she felt all terrific about that, and she immediately went to, not for a long time though, focusing on what she needs to be focused on. So teachers and us work together if they're allowing us. A lot of time we push the reason. I mean, tomorrow I will be going to, in fact, to college to meet with the parents, the student, and the people who's dealing with it. I'd like to be involved as much as I can.
We do it as much as is possible. Let me open up. I'm going to do 2 minutes on that biofeedback thing now. How many people in the room are concerned about issues related to attention deficit? Okay. Biofeedback is the use of sophisticated instrumentation. It's non-invasive. It's based on the principle of operant conditioning. It's been around for a long time. I've been doing it for about 20 years. Excuse me. What we have here is electroencephalograph biofeedback, brainwaves. We are teaching children to control the patterns of their brainwaves. The person who is in ADD is in what's known as theta, T-H-E-T-A brainwaves. That correlates with a lot of the negative symptoms like inability to concentrate, being disorganized, all the negative stuff you're used to. We're training them to get into beta, B-E-T-A, which is more of an ability to focus, to concentrate by changing the brainwaves. The fish story is the person has electrodes, they're attached to a computer. In order to make a game go in the right direction or the fish or whatever go in the right direction, that correlates with changes in the brain. The brain waves changing, the muscle tension going down, and blood being drawn into specific physiological areas. This is one of, you know, people say, what's available besides medication? What's available besides psychotherapy? These are good questions, you know, for the ADD syndrome. This is progressive. This is a pinch controversial. We've worked with about 100 kids on this. We have fairly good results. If you are measuring results in terms of increased ability to concentrate, increased performance on test scores, ability to do homework, controlling impulsive behavior. Doesn't work for everybody. I remember one of Eliron's first patients, and the mother came in and said to the child who was 10 years old, don't tell the doctor that you had the chocolate and the Coca-Cola before you came in. You know, if you have that kind of approach, it's not going to work. We've had a number of situations where children have been able to get off of medication or lessen the dosages of medication, but, you know, it takes a certain commitment to be able to do it. Most of the work that I had done previously with biofeedback was based on the treatment of panic attacks and headaches and other stress-related disorders, but this is an example of a very profound form of treatment. Do you want to add anything?
First of all, I think it's new and we don't have a lot of research. I bet that many parents who have ADD children heard about it. I'm doing it since 1991 or 1992. Probably I've had 100 patients. Yes, sir?
I have a question. When you're talking about this biofeedback,
right?
Could that be equated with when a child sits in front of a video game?
That is exactly what it is.
Concentrates on it?
That is okay.
So how do you make the jump from there to schoolwork?
Okay. Well, first of all, the child, actually, what he's seeing on the computer is his brainwave. The result of what he's doing, it's a biofeedback. It's not, there's no work between the computer and the child. It's only the child reading his brainwave. I mean, they get beautiful when I sit over there and I can see actually what is my brainwave. I feel more control of what I'm doing. Okay? So if the child is moving all the time, he does not get any score. He's not moving nowhere. The fish or whatever it is, the screen, the game that he's trying to play and get a lot of points does not work for him. So I might say, well, how about if you just sit quiet? Okay? So, and that's automatic response in the school. It's automatically. That's why we're doing it with him on a basis of twice a week in the beginning, then once a week. We give him a lot of, you know what you did right now? That's what I want you to do in school. I ask you to just be quiet, to sit, and you change your brainwaves. How about if that will happen to you in school when you feel that all the time you want to look out in the window because you're fed up with the teacher? How about if you go back to yourself? Remember the computer. So that is really, it's a very long process. And a lot of time we take kids from medication, and sometimes we ask kids to get some medication in the beginning because they are so hyper that actually they cannot sit down and do anything. So we might start with the medication and slowly wean them out of the medication.
This is the best technology available for anybody who is concerned about focus and performance issues. And to bring that point home, we've also worked with a number of athletes, forget learning disabilities, but athletes who want to improve their performance. I want to jump, okay, because time is becoming an issue. I want to go through this now. Okay. We handed out the sheet. And this is the crux of this, the parental guidelines. Just follow as I go through this. This is what parents have to do conceptually. We are talking about people who are, if you can read my handwriting here, so this is a non-clinical term, socially handicapped. And what it means is there is a combination of anxiety issues and social skills issues present. First of all, you have got to develop PMA. That is not PMS. PMA, positive mental attitude. If you don't believe that something is possible, if you don't have a positive approach to things, forget it. Nothing is going to work. You have to have belief, and this energy will be transmitted to your child, the negative or the positive, so it pays to start with the positive. You have to acknowledge that there is this social disability present, and the next step is to gauge the degree of it. In the envelope where we have the descriptive information, there's something that is called a social ability questionnaire. I developed this with an anthropologist and a psychologist about 12 years ago, and we tested it on a learning disabled population. Remember the concept of a map? You have to know where you're going. This will give you important information. It's for you to understand the basic issues. It can be a very effective tool in engaging in conversation or communication with the person in question. It's probably most effective for adolescents and upward. Now, it's very easy to take the test and to know what the answer is and to get a perfect score. Okay, so what you want to do is to integrate the parent's perception along with the child's perception. If your child says, I don't want to do it or I'm not going to talk about it, well, then you've got a resistance and you've got something else to work on.
What if the child is not self-aware enough to see that they have a problem?
Then it is the goal to, in a nurturing, as gentle but realistic as possible a way, to help that person engage in reality. Because if you are not in reality, you cannot move forward. That is the nature of resistance. Remember, resistance is having feelings that you don't want to deal with. Well, sometimes you have to bring those feelings in from another direction. Realize the person is, it's unlikely the person is going to grow out of this. I can't begin to impress upon you, when you see the patterns of this problem, which are social avoidance, anxiety in new situations, social particularly, overdependence on parents, social skills deficits, if the little child is the one who's always the one not invited to the birthday party, et cetera, the earlier that you can get intervention, the better their is for a chance of being productive. And again, the biggest mistake that I've seen is leave little Johnny alone, he'll grow out of it. Doesn't happen. Establishing goals is real important, short and long-term goals. I had this patient, he was learning disabled, bulimic, a cocaine abuser, no relationships. I asked the father in a session, I first began working with him, give me a good short-term goal for this person. Something you'd like to see happen in a month and a half. He said, I'd like him to feel good about himself. That's a long-term goal. Okay, you have to be real clear about short-term goals. Now, this is important because a lot of times when I'm working with a patient, I use the analogy, you're climbing a set of stairs. You know, you have to go one step at a time. They don't want to do it. They end up getting depressed because they have magical thinking that they want to do it all at once. Not possible, one step at a time based on short-term goals that turn into long. We have talked, number five, we have talked about the avoidant and dependent personalities in detail here. This is one of the most important things in this seminar. If you walk away remembering one thing, remember the avoidance dependence. You are the people dependent upon. It is very much what you do or don't do that will determine the outcome of the situation. And therefore, number seven, you must have a game plan. I remember once doing a radio show. This person called up, the father of a 35-year-old who was pathologically dependent. I hate to use the word, but it was true. And he was talking about the therapist of the daughter, and the father is paying for the therapy. The therapist will never talk to us. That kind of therapy will not work for this specific population, given the dependency. This is a real issue. We've talked about the enabling. You must understand your role as an enabler. You want to turn that into empowering. And we get back to the basic premise that nurturing here means helping the child face the fear or getting out of the comfort zone in the respect that it's not only anxiety, but teaching the child what they have to learn. I have a patient. This person is the perfect patient because he has come in with the perfect attitude. He is 19 years old. Comes from an extremely wealthy family, and his parents have a flourishing business. that he could probably take over one day. He will not go to work for his parents because he does not want to make mistakes. Doesn't want to make mistakes. Very hypersensitive to making mistakes. So his mother, being very influential, got him a job in a interning at a TV station. And he comes back after the first time there, and he was telling me, you know, did I do this right? Did I do that right? These were real good questions because it was an example of him getting out of his comfort zone. And it's real normal to have these issues. Did I do all right? But to deal with them instead of avoiding it, or else you can't learn. The brain is like a muscle. Sometimes when people come into my office, I do an analogy. I say, what's this? This is a muscle. You go to the gym, you work out the muscle. You come to our therapy, you're working out the brain muscle. So any self-help, any good therapy, is going to be based on making that muscle of the brain work better. Understanding, getting back to the dependency issues, you have a lot of power, which you may not be aware of, and that's why you have to make a list of these things on how your child is dependent on you, financially, emotionally, practically. And there's a lot of confusion here. Again, another story of this 30-year-old learning disabled woman who was working for her parents, and her parents brought her into a session of saying, she's really independent, she's really independent. This person was not independent. This person was totally unemployable if she was working anyplace else. She couldn't get a job. So the parents were deluding themselves, you know, in looking at the things that they interpret as being independent. But if they weren't looking realistically at the whole gestalt of things, again, there won't be productivity. Okay, parents being on the same team, major, major issue here. Two quickies here, two quick stories. Little Johnny, 14, comes home from school, gets together with his very best friend every day, the computer. Mother says, I think he has a problem, and he's got a learning disability too. I think he's got a problem. He never gets together with any friends. Father says, leave him alone, he looks content. Little Johnny says, get out of here, I'm okay. I have plenty of friends in school. The reality is, the friends in school are not friends, they are acquaintances. The father doesn't want to have anything to do with looking at reality and emotions. I hate to be sexist. I was going to write another book once called Memoirs of a Male, a Feminist Male Therapist, but I'm saving that for later. You didn't get that. I'm saving that for later. but more often than not, it is the female who is more nurturing in the sense that they are looking at reality. Again, I hate to generalize, but so often the fathers just don't want to have anything to do with it. And I hope I didn't turn anybody off with that, but that really is the truth. Unless these parents get on the same team, there won't be anything. Here's a more dramatic story. 38-year-old living at home, learning disabilities that have turned into a major psychiatric illness, and he barely leaves home, and he gets violent in the home. Mother and father are on two totally different teams. It was a sister who initiated therapy because when the parents die, the sister will be responsible for this person who did act, I hate to use the word, pretty much like a monster. You look at the history, and as this child was growing up, the mother was the one who said, I think we got to go for help.